Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. You're tuning in this podcast. You're going to hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred in the last week or so in the Tri-County, South Florida area. What are we talking about this week? Well, one story we're talking about is developers of apartment buildings. They're suddenly pausing construction. So we'll get into that. We're also going to look at the historic Burdines building. It's been replaced by a Ross. And maybe it's reflective of what's going on in downtown Miami, despite a lot of money coming from the public sector and the private sector. So we're going to talk to the writer who wrote that piece. We're also going to deal with a 10-year plan that's just been created by the daughter of a famous developer in Miami-Dade County, the Codina family. She's leading this initiative to go ahead and come up with a 10-year plan, how we can continue, we being Miami, continue on the momentum of what's occurred in the last few years. Another piece we're going to deal with. We're finally starting to see some first signs of what could happen with the 2025 Condo Association financial cliff, where a gentleman who bought a condo for 190 grand, he ended up unloading it for 110, taking a 42% loss. So we'll tell you what you can do if you are a owner of one of these older condos come January 2025. Well, if you're going to get into the Mai Kai, it was a Polynesian restaurant set up in the 1950s. It shut down. Well, it's ready for a rebirth, and we'll tell you all about that. And then finally, we will wrap up our podcast with a story about plans to increase the height of a landfill. They're talking 32-story landfill, putting in the top 10 structures in all of Broward County, which is where Fort Lauderdale is located. So on the other side of the break, we're going to get into our podcast.
Welcome to the CondoVultures.com podcast with your host, Peter Zalewski, a Miami real estate broker, Wall Street consultant, and expert witness. This podcast is focused on identifying real estate buying opportunities in the South Florida condo market, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. The CondoVultures.com podcast is not authorized by the South Florida real estate industry and will most likely annoy many of the region's talking heads. This podcast will feature straight talk and salty language that could be offensive to some. Please remember that past investment success does not determine future gains, especially in South Florida's volatile condo market. For more information, please visit CondoVultures.com.
This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. Before I started doing these podcasts, I'd been in the business of being a licensed real estate broker, a contributing columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the Miami Real Deal, but also extra witness work and consulting. So if you are looking for an expert witness, or if you're looking for consulting services, a straight talk perspective as to what's going on in a particular marketplace, a building, or what happened previously, for whatever your situation is, whether you are an attorney, whether you are an institutional fund looking to invest, or whether you're a lender who's trying to come up with some sort of a strategy and approach for your lending committee going forward, I don't just might be able to help you. To get a hold of me, please reach out to Peter@CondoVultures.com. That's Peter@CondoVultures.com. Or give me a call to the office at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859. This is Peter Zalewski of the Condo Vultures podcast. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. And I wanted to alert you that if you have a property that you're looking to sell in the Tri-County, South Florida area, I would encourage you to reach out to Jenny Cortez, a licensed real estate broker with CVRRealty.com. She's my partner. She's been in the business for north of 15 years. More importantly, she knows the market. She knows how to get that deal done. And she also realizes that it's more important to get a price that you can accept and sell the property rather than to hold firm on some price that's never going to be achieved and ultimately languish on the market. So if you're looking to do a deal that you want a skilled expert who can help you sell a property, reach out to Jenny Cortez at 305-865-5859, 305-865-5859, or visit her website, cvrrealty.com. Welcome to Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Zalewski from Condo Vultures. So you're tuning in this podcast. You're going to hear a conversation by current and former journalists talking about some of the biggest stories that have occurred in the last week or so. We're going to cut through the fluff. We're going to give you straight talk as to what's really going on in the market. Keep in mind, South Florida is a sell-side market. There's a lot of hyperbole, and a lot of times the information you're getting, it might be a little bit skewed. So our objective is to try to cut through it and give you the audience an idea of what's going on. We're going to discuss six stories that I handpicked, send them off to the journalist. I have three other journalists on the podcast with me. So let me go ahead and introduce our roundtable members this week. One of our regulars, gentleman was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he has a public relations marketing firm called Groos Communications. No one else but John Groos. I'd encourage you to check out his website, which is groosspr.com, G-R-U-S-S-P-R.com. And you can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get him at John Groos, J-E-A-N-G-R-U-S-S. Mr. Gruce, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Mr. Gruce, a little bit different of a background than people are accustomed to seeing you in. This is season 5, episode 9. Are you traveling or did you move?
I'm in the Conch Republic. It's great to be in Key West for a few days. And you got to get out of Miami once in a while, you know?
Speaking of never getting out of Miami, let's go to the next regular on our podcast. This gentleman was a journalist for over 20 years. He wrote about white collar crime. He did business stories. Last gig was with the South Florida Business Journal. Right now, he does public relations and marketing. His name is John Fackler. You can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, or you can get him on X Twitter, which, and his handle is JT Fackler, JTFAKLER. Mr. Fackler, how's it going?
It's going great. I guess compared to Jean and his travels, I'm more of a shut-in, but I'm glad to be back to the Fluffless Podcast. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, Mr. Fackler. Who is our visiting journalist this week? This gentleman has been a journalist for 15 years. He publishes the website called TheBigBubbleMiami.com, TheBigBubbleMiami.com. No one else but Sean McCaw. By the way, he was the founding editor of Curb Miami. Right now, he's doing a variety of different stories. He's available for freelance. Anybody out there, maybe looking for a freelance writer, maybe reach out to Sean. You want to get Sean on X, which is formerly Twitter, get him at Sean McCaw, SeanNcCaughan. What's going on, Sean?
I'm good. I did not have a quippy little response prepared. I guess I can just be meta and say I don't have a quippy little response prepared. So there I go.
There you go. Let me lay out some of the rules of engagement, then we'll go ahead and we'll get in our podcast. First and foremost, anybody has any comments for us, questions, you want to criticize, you want to compliment? We have thick skins. Feel free to reach out to us on X, which is formerly Twitter. Get us at Miami RRP, at Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast. Not AARP, but Miami RRP. The other point is the podcast is sponsored by my company. It's called CondoVultures.com, CondoVultures.com. We do anything and everything related to condos, whether it is statistics, it is expert witness work, it's consulting. We can do buy-side brokerage, and I'd encourage you to check out our newsletter, CondoVultures.com. So, all that being said, let's go ahead and get into our podcast. As mentioned, I handpicked 6 stories. I sent them off to the 3 other journalists on the podcast, asked them to read the stories. I'm going to read the headline, the first couple graphs. Then I'm going to ask the journalists to go ahead and provide some comments. And we are after straight talk, no fluff, as Mr. Fackler said. So let's start off with Jean Gruce with story number 1. Jean, this is a piece that's coming out of the real deal down here in Miami. I'll read you the headline for a couple graphs, and I want you to comment. And here we go with the headline. By the way, it was written by Lydia Dinkova, who was on our podcast in season 5, and she's one of our regulars. So what that's worth. Here we go, John. In quotes, in a holding pattern. Headline, South Florida apartment developers pause projects. Subhead, it's not just higher interest rates and skittish banks as Tri-County region has record construction underway amid flatlining of rents. And here we go with the first couple graphs. Developer Dan Cozzi isn't rushing to build multifamily projects in South Florida. 2 years ago, he jumped into the market with proposals for an apartment tower in Aventura and another in Miami. Now he's reevaluating the developments and tweaking both. It's too expensive to build high-rise apartments today, Cozzi said. The margins are very razor tight, and let's just say capital right now is not leaning in the multifamily. John, you've been talking about quite some time about way too many apartments were in the pipeline. They were under construction. They were recently completed. It was likely to contribute to some sort of pullback in rental prices. Is this basically verification and validation of what you were talking about, or is this maybe just an anomaly? What say you, Jean?
Yeah, thank you for telling me I was right. Well, you know, in season 4, I remember we discussed the fact that 40,000 units are coming online, and I mean it's a tsunami of apartments, and really the market cannot possibly absorb that many units. It's no surprise really that lenders are pulling back. I mean the financing and loose money basically financed a lot of apartments, and now that credit conditions have tightened and lenders are extremely skittish about apartments because of this oversupply, it's no surprise then that developers can't move ahead with projects.
Now, Jean, in terms of under construction today, it says over 40,700 units are currently under construction across South Florida, according to CoStar Group. That's just shy of the 42,500 units that were under construction in 2022. which was a record since 2006. Miami-Dade County is leading with 22,700 units alone, while Broward has more than 10,800 units under construction, and Palm Beach has just over 6,200 units. John, if rental rates are starting to pull back already, what's going to happen once this stuff comes online? And then subsequently, is all this stuff actually going to get completed, or is there a possibility we could see some unfinished towers standing along the landscape of South Florida?
Yeah, I mean, you already have developers that are talking about converting their apartments into condos. But, you know, we got a similar problem with condos, you know, coming on the market. I mean, I think some may never get built. That's for sure. And then, of course, the ones that are going to come online, you're already seeing a lot of incentives. We're seeing several months of free rent. We're seeing a lot of apartment vacancies, and that doesn't count all the existing inventory. And what's more, all these people who have purchased condos in recent years to turn them into rentals, thinking that they hit the jackpot with rental income. And, you know, it's just, all of those are not counted in all this new construction. So I think the only direction to rents is down from here.
Mr. Fackler, this is a no fluff podcast. You said at the beginning of the podcast that you love the fact it's no fluff. So let's talk no fluff. A couple of weeks ago, season 5, you had mentioned you thought rents were holding firm and actually going up. Are you willing to reverse and flip flop on what you said a couple of weeks ago about how rents were going up when I made the point that as I'm walking the streets, I walk the streets because I don't have a car and I take public transportation, no other reason. When I was walking the streets, I was saying I'm seeing 4 rent signs everywhere. Mr. Fackler, you pushed back and you said that wasn't necessarily what you were saying. Are you willing to rethink your position, or you still stand firm that rents will continue to go up, even though 40,000 units are under construction, according to Lydia Dinkova's piece in The Real Deal?
I'm willing to flip.
like the sports team, right? You're on the bandwagon of rents coming down. Is that what you're saying?
Listen, I could be bored, you know, or influenced by influencers. But I think that may happen. Of course, it probably will happen, but I think it's going to take some time, because I think what's happening is there's a pushback. I think people are used to getting the high rents, just like they get used to getting the high rates and prices for condos. And I think there's an ego thing attached to it that they're just fighting and thinking, okay, I'm going to push this go as high as I can for as long as I can. And then eventually, you know, it's just going to be supply and demand.
So if you're out there and you're a tenant, you might have lower rents coming your way. And if you're a landlord, you better give some consideration, because in the very near future, if rents continue to go down, you might actually be subsidizing a tenant to live in your place when you factor in insurance costs, condo association fees, and so on and so forth. So let's go on with story number two. Story number two, we're going to go to Sean McCaw. This is a piece that he wrote. It appeared in thebigbubblemiami.com, thebigbubblemiami.com, which is a website and newsletter that he publishes. Sean, I'll read you the headline first, couple of graphs that I want to sort of give us some insight. And I should tell the audience that you're actually born and raised in Miami, so you're going to be able to provide some on the ground unicorn perspective. What I mean by unicorn is you're one of the few that's actually born and raised here. Many other people are transplants. So here we go with the headline first, couple of graphs. TheBigBubbleMiami.com headline: the historic Burdine's flagship store in downtown Miami is now a Ross. Ross Dress for Less, which is basically a buyer of excess inventory. They buy it at a discount and then they undercut their department stores. So here we go with the first couple graphs. Again, headline: the historic Burdine's flagship store in downtown Miami is now a Ross. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. The historic downtown Miami Flagler Street flagship of our beloved former hometown department store Burdine's was for many years a Macy's after the department store Behemoth bought it. Now it's a Ross Dress for Less. The multi-level space, which is really quite large and includes 2 buildings and a 3-story footbridge, was once a show place for a thriving Flagler Street. But in 2019, news broke that Ross had signed a lease. At some point, the pandemic hit and the big bubble is unsure if Ross had a chance to open in that time for that, or waited for the pandemic to abate and quietly open later on along a much quieter Flagler Street, which is much more likely. Sean, why don't you give us a compare and contrast? What Flagler Street used to be? What was it like when Burdine's was there prior to Macy's acquiring them? And then have you had a chance to go to Ross since it's open? And, you know, how does it compare?
I mean, I
I remember a little bit of what it was like when Burdines was there. That Flatbush Street had its glory days, you know, in the 50s and before that. But always kind of survived and trucked along. Yeah, I mean, it was when Macy's bought the chain, you know, they opened a Macy's there. Flagler Street was successful enough to sustain a Macy's. You know, it wasn't glamorous with a lot of other big chains, but Flagler Street was a vibrant downtown street for a long time. I at first I was thinking, and Peter kind of laughed about this, that Ross, I said Ross was sort of the grim reaper of urban retail streets, because it seems like, you know, I mean, not like Lincoln Road not only has a Ross but also has a Marshalls. But then I thought about some more, and Ross is everywhere. Maybe it's somewhat of a bellwether of, you know, not so great things to come, but I think a bigger knock-on effect for these areas was the pandemic, and was of course the fact that the downtown powers that be seemed to want to redo Flagler Street every 5 days or years or whatever. I mean, it's being redone again now. If there's any time not to redo somewhere, it's when it's already been sort of killed by the pandemic. Flagler Street's a ghost town. Lincoln Road is a good example. Lincoln Road, I was there in the middle of the day a couple of days ago. There were people there, and Lincoln Road was really affected by the pandemic. But, you know, people kind of comment, oh, Lincoln Road's not what it used to be. It's a ghost town now. But it was active. It wasn't insanely hopping like it used to be pre-pandemic. Like, you know, when it was had some of the highest retail rents, like, in the world, but it was active. Now Flagler Street is just dead and closed off to everything. And Ross has probably been struggling. I'd be surprised if they're getting much business. I mean, you know, they're everywhere, for God's sake. So there we go. Flagler Street just needs people. Needs to be open to people again.
And speaking about being open to people, there's a, let's call it an entrepreneur, an investor, a developer, whatever you want to call it, a gentleman called Moishe Mana.
What's up with, you know, is he still not announced what he's doing?
From what I understand, this Moishe Mana came in here, he bought a bunch of land, basically. Yeah. Most of the tenants were all kicked out. There's a plan to try to turn it into some sort of arts or tech type of district. And anybody who doesn't know, Flagler Street is the meridian. It's divided between north, south. Miami Avenue, mm-hmm. just to the west, or right where mm-hmm. Burdines is located, would actually be where all of the directionals sort of come up in Miami. But Sean, what I want to ask you about Moishe Mana is, he's got this idea about tech, and he's got this idea about arts. And whenever we have Art Basel, he's trying to incorporate pop-ups where they show artwork. So I'm wondering, is Ross sort of playing it right where they came in, they took this space, and now lo and behold, Moishe might turn it into something rock star and spectacular? Or is this sort of a testament of kind of what's going to happen with Moishe and his investment, which is basically a whole variety of projects and buildings up and down Flagler Street that are right now vacant? So what would be your take on it, Sean, as somebody born and raised in Miami?
Oh, what do you mean? Like, I don't see how Ross and Moishe would work together. I mean, Ross is leasing it from somebody else, I assume.
Yeah. But I'm saying that I'm saying the vibe, like back in the day when Midtown Miami.
Is it going to be more like mid low end strip mall corporate or artsy vibrant?
Correct. So I'm wondering if Ross is suggesting, okay, this is all that you could justify on that vacant space.
I mean, I think that's
or
a big,
is this an opportunistic?
I have
play
no
by
idea.
Ross?
I think. This is the point where Miami decides which way it's going to be. I mean, Ross was a bellwether of Lincoln Road becoming more corporate, and now there's a Cheesecake Factory there. When Lincoln Road, you know, used to be super artsy. And Lincoln Road is still somewhat artsy, but, you know, not like it used to be, of course. who knows? I mean, Moishe's been saying he's going to do this artsy stuff for years, since before the pandemic, unless he's announced something post-pandemic that I'm unaware of. I don't know.
Interesting. Sean doesn't know. What about John or Mr. Factor? Either you have an opinion. You have this developer or this investor who comes out of Israel, which, by the way, the Miami Herald did a piece on him, a sidebar, back in 2022. And apparently, he's a big investor. He's got plantations. He grows and exports mangoes, limes, and other fruits out of Colombia, just outside of Medellin. Sean or Mr. Feckler, Ross going into this area where Boschimano wants to go ahead and turn it into a tech and a arts district, is that a sign of Ross being opportunistic and getting in and taking advantage of maybe well-heeled people who might be coming ultimately if he's successful? Or does it reflect more so the fact that you can't lease the space, but anybody who's basically dumping at a discount retail type of merchandise?
Well, I don't know. I mean, of course, you've got a Ross in Wynwood, right? I mean,
there was in a Ross Midtown, there? Yeah, across the street
Midtown,
from the design
right?
district,
Midtown.
Basically, okay. Yeah. And that hasn't killed the Target next door.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So I don't know. I don't know if you can use that as a bellwether. So it's sort of like kind of teetering on whether it is or not.
And Mr. Gruce, any thoughts on that as somebody who lived off of Brickell for quite some time and you're always in and around, you're jogging and doing all that type of stuff?
You walk around or run in Brickell and then you cross the bridge over the river and you run around downtown. I mean, it totally different vibes. I mean, downtown is deserted, street people everywhere, boarded up shops, old buildings crumbling that seem to be crumbling. It's really very, very depressing. That area is very depressing. And then you cross the river, back across the river into Brickell, everything's shiny and new and exciting and restaurants and clubs and, bling everywhere. I mean, it's a totally different vibe. And so if you're trying to attract tech, the tech bros are not going to be hanging out in downtown Miami. They're going to be in Brickell and, where all the action is. So, I mean, you're competing with that. As far as Moishimana, I mean, when I came to Miami 6 years ago, he was talking about doing this and doing that. He's acquired more than land. He's acquired like some 50 buildings, I think, in that downtown area. And I think he was building something to have a big scale, something up. But I think the pandemic got in the way. Nobody's going back to the office. And then, since then, like really nothing's happened. There's been the streetscaping on Flagler, but I don't think streetscaping or landscaping is going to do a whole lot for that area. But who knows,
Interesting. Interesting conversation, gentlemen. Let's go on with story number three. Mr. Fackler, we're going to go to you with story number three, John Fackler. Here is the headline. Here's the first couple graphs, and then I'm going to ask you to comment. Coming from the Miami Herald, it's actually an op-ed piece. It comes from a woman called Anna Maria Codina Barlick. Anybody doesn't know the Codina name? Armando Codina is a developer. Did residential. He also did office, but primarily he was known for pretty much building a certain level of industrial space, mixed-use industrial space out in what would later go on to become Doral, which is just west of Miami International Airport. They were offering kind of like a Class A industrial space or warehouse space when many people were just basically, putting up shit, lack of a better word. Codina brings it. He gets big rents, makes a fortune, goes on, serves on a number of different boards of directors for Fortune 500 types of companies, many of which are based down here in Miami. Now the daughter has taken over the operation. And by the way, Mr. Codina was affiliated and probably still is with Jeb Bush, the Bush family fortune, if you will. So that's kind of the background. So this is the op-ed piece written and submitted to the Miami Herald by Mr. Codina's daughter, Anna Maria Codina Barlick. And here's the headline. Let's work together to forge a Miami that works for all. And here's the first couple graphs from Mr. Fackler. I've long recognized that Miami and I are interconnected. I was born and raised here. After going away for school, I was drawn back to Miami to pursue my career and start a family. It has shaped who I am by giving me unique opportunities to work and life. like any lifelong Miamian, I've tracked the city's ups and downs. There have been times when this amazing city has not been taken seriously or counted out entirely. More recently, the city's spirit and dynamism have ushered in a new phase. Miami's become a high-growth commercial hub and a preferred destination for businesses and investment. No other city offers the same opportunities for entrepreneurs and executives alike. It's a frontier town that welcomes and provides a supportive environment for anyone with the idea and a work ethic. So, Mr. Fackler, I just wonder, and why don't you tell the audience about what else Armando Codina's daughter has to say, and then just give us your take on that.
Well, you know, I was very curious about this. I think it's a very interesting private partnership that is going forward. There's been a lot of success in other cities with this kind of initiative. Los Angeles, Chicago, D.C. was mentioned. And I really, you know, when you read this, you say, well, this is really a positive thing. But if, you know, I just wonder how much of this is actually self-serving. You've got, well, you know, we've talked about it ad nauseum on this show. Jean has talked about it. We talked about it a little bit today. You have all these very expensive apartments going up. They're really geared for high end. They're geared for international buyers. You've got an infrastructure that really doesn't support that. And then you have billionaires we talked about before, like Ken Griffin, who are bringing in the financial people that never really worked out because a lot of people went back to work. We're in there. The tech bros, for example, from California. This almost looks like an amalgamation of all of these entities together, working together to try to, you know, make something happen. Now, you know, but again, when I say self-serving, I mean, it's, you know, you talk about a real estate developer, you're talking about, you know, all of these different entities who we talked about on this program that might have been suffering because you don't have apartments for the middle class, for the teachers, for the firemen, you know, and you've got all these thousands of units going up. And will they be filled? Could it be that the real estate people are really worried about that? Could it be there, you know, I mean.
And Mr. Vagram, if I could just piggyback on that. So Anne Marie Codina, she's co-chairing this 22-member business panel. It includes billionaire Ken Griffin. Ken Griffin's right. The gentleman from Citadel, ultra wealthy, overpays for a lot of stuff because he wants it. Both be building a billion-dollar office tower, bought a bunch of units over in the Faena, condominium on the beach before ultimately sold them at a steep loss. He's bought some land from Adrian Arsh, the same woman who the Performing Arts Center down here is named after. He's also featured in that movie, Dumb Money. I encourage anybody, go to Netflix, watch the movie Dumb Money. It has to do with GameStop stock and the Roaring Kitty, just to give you some context. So, but Mr. Fackler, what I wanted to mention, though, is this plan that they're creating, these 22 business-type leaders, it's called Miami 2035, a Miami that works for all. I've been here since 1993, and anytime I see a partnership kind of in the name of something, it says to me there's a problem. The most prevalent one to me was the community health or the community partnership that was created to deal with the homeless back in 1996 when there was a federal order that stopped the police from arresting homeless people. So Mr. Becker, to hit on your point, is there an issue going on here that the business community is concerned about and that's why they're putting this together? Or are they trying to simply take it to the next level? Because I will remind you, Ken Griffin from Citadel said on the record that Miami will replace New York City as the financial capital of the United States. So what say you, Mr. Beckler?
Well, call me cynical. I mean, you know, I mean, that was one of the first things I thought of, you know, I was that maybe there's something amiss. And because, you know, we talked about it ad nauseum for the last year or two. I'm all for the kumbaya. You know, let's get it together. I hope everything works out. I would love Miami to be in that spot, but for it to be in New York South, it's going to really, especially in the financial part of the business, I don't know if that's really going to ever happen. So, but that's just one component of this whole idea. But I'm thinking that they sort of join forces here and say, okay, listen, you know, it's time to put up or shut up because, you know, she even mentioned in the op-ed that, you know, she's seen the positivity and the negativity within the city. And she doesn't want to see it go negative. She wants to, you know, build on the positivity. And, you know, that's great. It's going to be a tough road, though, in my opinion.
Sean McCaw, the author of this, Anna Marie Codina, She says she's born and raised. You were born and raised. Can you give us any kind of context about this 10-year plan that they have to take us to 2035 and turning Miami into something and building on the momentum? Do you have any take on it? And is this positive momentum where people can't afford to rent a place, they can't afford to buy a place, traffic is still out of control, or am I a little bit too skeptical?
Anything I might have to say has already been said here. It could be very self-serving. It reminds me of some plans that the Related Group has cooked up, which have been always kind of been a curious mixture of beneficial for them, but also illegitimately beneficial for the city in a way. I mean, but as far as this, I no comment. I really don't.
Oh, well, Sean, let me ask you this. You recognize the Cordina name.
Yes.
You recognize Armando Cordina.
Mm-hmm.
The development, the relationship with the Bush family, all that type of stuff. Does his daughter carry the same sway as Armando Cordina? So should she be the one co-chairing this partnership in terms of moving mountains, make things happen? Or is that just a little bit of nepotism?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose the youth aspect. I mean, having her write
good
it
point.
Speaks to the future. I mean, how old is he? Probably, you know, you said he's handing over the reins to the next generation.
Yeah, he's definitely long in a tooth. Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe this has to do with that. Handing the reins to the next generation and putting her in the spotlight.
Interesting. Jean Bruce, why don't you give us your take? Mr. Fackler is kind of pessimistic. Sean, he says, hey, maybe it's a younger person. Maybe they have a new vision. How do you read it?
You know, I used to cover economic development for the Tampa Tribune a long time ago. And these kinds of partnerships and self-selective groups generally did not get a lot accomplished. It was more sort of a networking opportunity for a few select people and, sharing leads among themselves for deals. That's sort of my experience covering sort of these kinds of efforts. They may be well-intentioned, but until we see some results, I think I'd reserve judgment on something like this.
Interesting. Okay. Well, interesting conversation. I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot about it as we go forward. Let's go on with story number four. Jean Bruce, we're going to you with story number four coming out of the Wall Street Journal. I'll read the headline for the graph, then I want you to provide some comments. Headline, new Florida law roils its condo market 3 years after Surfside collapse. Subhead, more units are being dumped on the market because of six-figure special assessments tied to repairs for older buildings. And here we go with the piece. First couple graphs. Ivan Rodriguez lucked at the chance to buy a unit in the Cricket Club, an exclusive Bayfront condominium in North Miami. In 2019, he liquidated his 401k retirement account to purchase a nearly 1,500-square-foot unit with water views for about $190,000. But because of recent state law that requires older buildings to meet certain structural safety standards, the condo board recently proposed a nearly $30 million special assessment for repairs, including roof replacement and facade waterproofing. It would amount to more than $134,000 for a unit. The guys did it for $190,000. They want $134,000 special assessment. By the way, if anybody wants to know where this is going to be just north of Miami Shores, if you will, right there in that area. So it'd be south of 123rd on Biscayne Boulevard and north of, let's call it the Quayside mixed-use development. So story goes on to say, Rodriguez, 76, he didn't have the money. So he reluctantly put his two-bedroom condo for sale, joining dozens of others in the building who are doing the same. After originally listing his unit for $350,000, remember, he paid $190,000. After listing it for $350,000, he kept marking it down until finally it sold for $110,000 last month, a 42% less or discount off of what he paid. Every time a potential buyer learned of the assessment, he said they'd run in the opposite direction. John, I'm assuming with the 2025 Condo Association financial cliff that basically kicks in January of next year, roughly 7 months or so from now, all these associations, these older buildings, they all had to do structural integrity studies. They then have to earmark money in order to fix the stuff. I'm assuming this is just the beginning of what is likely to be an avalanche of old shitty condo buildings getting flooded onto the market. Am I getting that right, or am I maybe a little bit off there?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's the dark side of condo ownership, you know, already most of these buildings can't get financing. Buyers can't get financing to purchase units because the lenders will refuse to finance any owner that where the building is not being maintained or kept up as it should be. I mean, the one thing is, a lot of these buildings are going to be terminated. The condos will be terminated, and developers will come in and redevelop them. I mean, if they're lucky. And if the real estate market continues, to grow, and which, you know, not a guarantee. So, it's going to be really pivotal. I think having sort of this national exposure from the Wall Street Journal I'm really curious to see what happens now, because I mean, you might be getting some, investors who might want to lowball some of these, you know, to purchase a bunch of these units in the hopes that maybe a developer will buy them out at a premium. And that's possible. So we're getting a lot of national attention. I just don't know if it's going to be good or bad. But it's certainly, we have so many older condo buildings up and down the coast. It's going to be an incredibly pivotal year, I think. And we're going to see a lot of changes.
And anybody wondering about it, basically in 2021, when we had that disaster, the Surfside collapse, when the tower went down, nearly 98 people died, $1 billion payout was made. It was, the property was located on the Barrier Island, just north of Miami Beach, and just south of Sunny Isles Beach. It went down. It upset the entire insurance industry. It had the underwriters start to realize, oh, shit, there's a bunch of old buildings in Florida. And what happens if this happens again? The feds got involved. They're currently investigating it. Some of the early preliminary reports are suggesting maybe some improper construction, as well as a lack of maintenance along the way, which is why the Florida legislature, in order to get insurers to come back in the game, they made some rules that said, come 2025, all these associations, they got to study what's wrong. So they bring in experts, and then they got to actually fund it to actually get the stuff fixed. And that's why we're seeing these significant increases in the maintenance fees at many of these condominium associations. So let me open the floor to Mr. Fackler or to Sean. Gentlemen, season 5, we've been discussing this a lot. We're talking about, would you live in one of these older buildings? Is there an investment opportunity? What do you guys make of a guy paying $190,000? 5 years later, he dumps it for $110,000. What do you make of the investor? Did that investor who paid $110,000, did they do okay? Or are they maybe trying to catch a falling knife where the prices might actually go lower? Anybody have any thoughts?
How big is the unit?
1,500 square feet.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I grew up in Miami Shores, pretty close to there. I the cricket club, it's at the exclusive cricket club. That place hasn't been exclusive for 35 years. although it is on a decent sized piece of land. So, I mean, I think it would be okay. A lot of these places could be attractive to vulture developers swooping in. You know, the cricket club is on a lot of land, so that would make it attractive, I think. And $110,000 seems pretty good, even with the $130,000 assessment, because after that, it's still only $240,000 for 1,500 square feet.
You know, it's interesting. To this day,
probably water view.
Many years ago, the older buildings were always bigger. My first apartments, my first condos were huge. They were in old buildings, you know, dilapidated shitholes. But they were huge. And now, I mean, obviously, with the new developments, they're much smaller units for a reason. It's, you know, as far as the square footage goes. But I think that's always kind of interesting. I'm not really sure if it's catching a falling knife. If you can get a place that's old, that's at least decent, and it's huge, you know, maybe there's some value there.
But you may not be able to live in it.
Well, that's true.
Well, and John, what I think what you mean by you might not be able to live in it is the local government officials have shown they're willing to step up give you 15-minute notice to grab anything you can and then not return to your unit until the building basically has some sort of approval that it's actually safe. We did a story this season talking about a place up in North Miami where people haven't been in there in 2.5 years. And what they're having to do is they have to continue to pay their maintenance fee. They have to pay a special assessment there. They have to pay a mortgage if they have it. They have to pay property taxes. Then they have to pay for themselves to live elsewhere while this building is being rectified or made safe again. So I think that's what you're referring to, Jean Gruzard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Am I right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things that's different this time, I think, than Hurricane Andrew back in 1992, and I got here a year later in 1993, a lot of things changed after Andrew hit because insurance companies took a real licking in order to go ahead and build and have insurance companies come back. They wanted to make sure certain standards were in place so you wouldn't see it again. But it was primarily limited to Miami-Dade County. This law with the 2025 Condo Association Financial Cliff that people refer to, this is statewide. So there's many counties of the 67 counties of Florida where they don't have these types of rules that we have down here in South Florida. And you can just wonder what's going to go on with many of these old buildings. And more importantly, how are you going to get a contractor? If we're building all these rental units, if we're building all these condos, where are you going to get workers from to actually do the work that's necessary for these associations? Okay, story number five. Let's go on to Sean McCall with story number five. This piece appeared in thebigbubblemiami.com, thebigbubblemiami.com. It's a real estate website as well as a newsletter. Sean is the publisher. Sean, I'm going to read you the headline, first couple of graphs, and I want you to provide some insight in some context, if you will, for the audience. Here we go. Headline, Fort Lauderdale's iconic Mai Kai is on track for a summer reopening after a big restoration. Anybody doesn't know what the Mai Kai was, a 1950s Polynesian themed restaurant that opened up it's more like an entertainment type of facility. And
dinner theater, right?
Yeah, dinner theater. So this place opens in the 1950s. It's a legendary place to go to. It's got a big price tag if you want to go have dinner and watch some of this Polynesian themed entertainment as well as chow down on some of the food. Located right there on Oakland Park Boulevard in Federal. So at the time that they opened it in 1950s, it was basically nothing there. And then all of a sudden the market grew around it. And now the dirt became very expensive. So fast forward and roughly 5 years ago or so, 4 years ago, there's a bad rain. Sprinklers are triggered. The whole roof collapses over the kitchen. Things shuts down. Ultimately, a new partner is brought in, a guy called Bill Fuller. Bill is known because he is the one who has Ball and Chain in Miami. He's the one who sued the commissioner of Miami, Joe Carollo, got the big judgment against him, continues to sue the city of Miami. So that's some of the context. So let me get back into Sean McCall's story in thebigbubblemiami.com. Again, headline, Fort Lauderdale's iconic Mai Kai is on track for a summer reopening after a big restoration. And here's the first couple graphs. The Mai Kai, Fort Lauderdale's fabulous mid-century tiki-themed dinner theater, was a victim of a massive flood collapse in late 2020, putting it in danger of total demolition. However, being saved by a new restaurateur, bringing the old girl's glamour back with an elaborate $15 million renovation, restaurant's on track for a summer reopening with a phase two following afterwards. According to Atomic Grog, a slightly obsessive tiki lover blog that goes into lots of details with many of its updates on the property, that they're even resurrecting a vintage kind of rum originally used in old school tiki cocktails back in the glory days. The restoration is very visible at the site itself, including lots of outdoor work, a brand new sign, and what looks like a complete reconstruction around the back of the property. Sean, hey, tell us about the Mai Kai. You're born and raised in Miami in this area. I'm sure you've been there or passed it many times. What do you remember it being? And then what does it sound like? Where does it sound like it's going?
I mean, a lot of old, tourist attraction things that locals go to once or twice in their lives. I've been to, sure. The Mai Kai is not one of those, unfortunately. I never actually. I've been on the Jungle Queen. I've been, to this, that, but I've not been to the Mai Kai. So hearing that it had a big hole in its roof mid-pandemic was a tragic loss. And I was glad to hear that it was being resurrected, and I will go when they reopen. Fingers crossed. I noticed on the Atomic Grog. I mean, give credit where credit is due. I guess this Atomic Grog website, maybe you should have had him on instead of me. Has been following it in obsessive detail. So I noticed that they were, that they mentioned a summer reopening. And, you know, every now and then I do drive by and I take a picture or two, whatever. And I just wanted to do a little update, and it got a lot more traction than I thought it would. But I mean, not totally surprised. I mean, the Maikai is iconic locally, but the post got a lot more traction than I thought it would. And, you know, the Enchanted Tiki Room when I was a kid was always my favorite ride. Well, one of my favorite rides, Disney World's ones. So I imagine it being something like that.
And Sean, what we're seeing a lot of, at least in my opinion, and maybe you could comment on this, we're seeing these old Miami or South Florida institutions that are basically, they're not passed on to the next member of the family. They're basically going defunct. And then these groups are popping up, taking them out, restoring them, changing the menu a little bit, jacking up the prices. I could give you some examples. We have Tobacco Road. We have the Ball and Chain. Ball and Chain, Bill Fuller, who's doing the Maikai. He was the one who brought back Ball and Chain, which at some point before I-95, when everybody would take Tamiami Trail, which is Tioga or 8th Street, to get from Miami to Tampa. This is one of the stops kind of along the way. You have Foxes in South Miami, same type of situation. I'm just wondering, Sean, is this good or bad that some of these younger generation restaurateurs are coming in, salvaging these iconic brands, at least locally, and restoring them, even though they're changing the menu a little bit and they're jacking up the prices incredibly. So do you have any opinion on that?
Generally, yeah. I mean, I think it's good generally, especially depending on how authentically it's restored. The Ball and Chain, when I've been there, it's always seemed fabulous to me. I mean, some places have been, at least in my opinion, changed a little too drastically. There was this one little piano lounge on 79th Street called Magnum.
Yes.
Which was a little too radically redone for, I mean, I don't even think they have the piano anymore.
They don't.
But it was great. I loved it. They did show tunes around the piano. It was great. But, you know, it just depends on how much. There's good and bad, you know, changes. But ultimately, I think the fact that people are trying to preserve something is a good thing, you know.
Mr. Facco, let me ask you, you lived in South Florida since the 1980s. Can you give us some sort of perspective? Well, first of all, I'm assuming you've been to the Maikai because you lived right in and around that area. Could you give us some perspective about what it was like back then? What kind of crowd hung out there now and what your expectations would be going forward for this Maikai restoration that should be opening this summer?
Well, interesting enough, I have never been to the Maikai, but I have been to Ball and Chain. And I have seen a little bit about what we're talking about now, a restoration, sort of a modernization, which I felt lost a lot of the flavor of what it's been. A real Latin, a Cuban dancing, the whole bit. We had a couple of years ago, Investa came in and sort of redid the whole feel of the place. And I never thought it lost something. And I'm wondering if that's what's going to happen at these Maikai. I'm curious if the same thing's going to happen with that. How much renovation was done? Is it going to have a feel of the old place? Are they going to keep the original feeling of that? Because, like I said, the Ball and Chain has changed, I think, a lot for the worse, in my opinion. I mean, again, I haven't been to the Maikai, but I just hope they keep the original flavor of it. Because without that, I mean, there's a great history there. You know, Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, all these, Hollywood types used to hang out there. And it was, that's part of the whole charm.
So let's go on to story number six. Story number six, John Facco, we're going to go to you with story number six. I'm going to read you the headline, first couple graphs, and I want you to comment. This piece is actually coming out of the South Florida Sun Sentinel. So here we go with the headline. A bigger Broward landfill whose peak may reach 325 feet. And by the way, typically when you're trying to gauge the how many floors in a building, typically use 10 feet. So 325 feet would suggest this is between a 32 and a 33-story tall landfill in Broward County, which, by the way, would be in Pompano Beach. It would be just south of Boca Raton, ritzy Boca Raton, and northwest of Fort Lauderdale. Debate ensues over site's growth. This is the rest of the headline. Now I'll read you the first couple graphs. The debate over whether Broward's landfill should be taller by 100 feet and wider too is coming to a vote within months. And Waste Management warns that if its plans don't go through, it will be forced to truck garbage elsewhere, which will come at high price increase for residents. Broward County Commissioner said they will hear the petition by Waste Management for the expansion of the Monarch Hill Renewable Energy Park located at 2700 Wilds Road. Monarch Hill is known as Mount Trashmore by some locals through the years. It's a 1965-era landmark that can be seen from miles away, sitting in an unincorporated part of Broward County. In 2021, Waste Management warned it needed to expand both horizontally and vertically. Then in 2022, Waste Management told county officials the current landfill could only have enough space to take in trash for another 8 to 9 years, and so expansion was needed. It now says effective January 2024. It's got about 6 years left before it's tapped out. Mr. Fackler, why don't you give us your take on this story, and then why don't you share with us some maybe personal experience you have to this particular Mount Trashmore in Broward County?
Well, not only could you see it for miles, you could smell it for miles. I actually lived in North Broward and used to travel past Mount Trashmore hundreds of times. And I mean, the place stank. I mean, you knew you were getting close because you could smell it. Now, there's been many changes over the years where Waste Management has agreed to take a lot of the home disposal stuff, dirty diapers, you know, food, all the stuff that stank, to different places. And they're still trying to negotiate that where it'll be just, you know, they'll leave, you know, what they can will be mostly construction debris and stuff like that. And they're going to get rid of the smell. But, 32 stories.
Yep.
Well, that would rival any downtown tower in Fort Lauderdale. So could you imagine having that on the west side? I mean, that's unbelievable.
I pulled the numbers from Wikipedia. If this was a residential, well, let's say based on view, residential wise, this would be the fifth tallest tower residential in all of the Fort Lauderdale area. Number one being 100 Las Olas at 46 stories. Number two is Icon Las Olas at 42. Las Olas Riverhouse, 42. Las Olas Grand at 38. And then number five is actually 110 Tower coming in at 30 stories. So this is a very sizable place. I mean, is 32-story landfill, is that doable? And what about driving up 32 stories and dump a bunch of trash?
Well, it's always precarious. If you ever drive fast, and you can see the trucks, you know, going up these little dirt roads, and you just went waiting for them to topple over as it is now. Now you're going to add another 100 feet, I think they said,
yes,
to what's there already.
Which would be 10 stories.
Yeah. Now, one of the things Waste Management is proposing is moving some of this to, of all places, other cities, including Southwest Ranches, which caught my attention because that's a very ritzy area. People feel like, you know, nobody wants that garbage in their backyard. I mean, Southwest Ranches, forget about it. Ironically, too, and this was buried in the story, Peter, you might have caught this, but there's a rival situation going on in Miami-Dade where they're having problems with the landfills there.
Mr. Fackler, if I could interrupt. Yeah, there was an incinerator in the Durrell area that caught fire
about
a year ago or so. And the local residents didn't want to rebuild, so they're shipping stuff to Broward now.
Right. Well, the interesting proposal was they wanted to move it. One of the cities proposed was Miramar, but as soon as it was announced, the mayor threatened to sue. So there's a lawsuit being threatened because they don't want it in their backyard. So obviously, it's all going to shit, no pun intended. And nobody wants their trash in their backyard. It seems like it's going to be an ongoing problem for years to come.
Okay, I want to open it to the floor, but Mr. Fackler, let me ask you the question everybody watching or listening to this podcast is thinking themselves. Why the hell did you buy a home by a landfill? What was your rationale? Could you walk us through that?
I never bought a home. I wasn't that close. I mean, I was several miles to the east. This is somewhat west. I think it's off of 441 or 95.
This is just south of Coconut Creek where you used to have a home.
Yeah, exactly. But there was, you know, my townhouse was nowhere near the landfill. I didn't smell it or see it, but I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay. Just answer that question. Sean McCarr, Sean Bruce, we have roughly 6.2 million people in South Florida. We have 2.7 in Dade, about 2 million in Broward. We have 1.5 in Palm Beach County. Looking at the numbers and asking, hey, Google, which she's probably listening to me right now, we have effectively 8 landfills. Everybody's talking about population growth. So I guess the question to the two of you is,
at some point, this is going to become an issue. China used to buy trash from the United States. They're no longer buying it the same way they used to. Now they're shipping it to places like Cambodia and Thailand. Trash is ultimately an issue. And if we want to live our quality of life, and if we're down here in South Florida, where we have the Atlantic to the east, the Everglades to the west, at some point, you need to take the trash somewhere. 32-story landfill. You guys have any thoughts on that? Or is there maybe, have you read anything about maybe how technology might be able to eliminate this as we go forward?
Obviously, we need a sustainable way to deal with our garbage, and landfills are not sustainable. But what about, I mean, eventually, would that make a pretty gnarly park with that huge mountain? I mean, there's the Fresh Kills landfill, Fern Park in Staten Island. You know, they don't need mountains up there. They've already got them. But this would give us a 40-story mountain, you know, in on a flat peninsula. There's definitely something interesting we could do with that.
And Sean, to your point, Sola Mia, which is a development Sulphur and Turnberry.
Right, but when it's
Lafrette,
it was like a super.
It was a Superfund site. Superfund site at 151st in Biscayne. It basically, they didn't know what the hell was there. The federal government gave it Superfund money. It's now been somewhat remediated, and I use that in air quotes. I'm not a scientist. And now they're building residential there. They built a Costco. There's a school there. Mm-hmm. From what I'm told, though, you don't want to dig. You can't be digging any around there because they laid some sod and dirt, and yeah, everything is copacetic right now. But it is a waterfront site. So is that what you're referring to, Sean?
Well, Staten Island has this huge landfill that Robert Moses built that they're turning into a park called Fresh Kills, ironically. and just like this isn't this Mount Trashmore called the sustainable garbage? What did you call it?
Yeah. The official name is the Renewable Energy Park. So I guess it's been repositioned from Mount Trashmore and landfill
but if they
to Renewable
can turn
Energy Park.
Fresh Kills into a park. This could ultimately be turned into a park as well with a gigantic mountain, which is very, very unusual for South Florida. And could, you know, we could do some really interesting things with that as long as nobody, you know, digs a hole, I guess.
So with that, let's go ahead and end our podcast for this week. I want to thank everybody for participating. Let me thank John Groose. He was a journalist for over 25 years. Right now, he does public relations and marketing at his own public relations firm called Groose Communications. You should check out his website, groosepr.com, groosepr.com, groussepr.com, and get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, at Sean Groose, JeanGrusse. Let me thank John Fackler. He was a journalist for over 20 years, covered white collar crime, most recently at the South Florida Business Journal. Now he does public relations and marketing. You can get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, at JT Fackler. JTFAKLER. And let me thank Sean McCaw. He's our visiting journalist this week. He publishes the Big Bubble Miami newsletter and website. TheBigBubbleMiami.com is where you can check it out. You can also get him on X, which is formerly Twitter, at Sean McCaw, SeanMcCauGhan. And I'm Peter Zalewski of Condo Vultures. Thanks for tuning in. If you have any comments for us, any questions, any criticisms, send them to our X handle, which is Miami RRP, which stands for Miami Reporters Roundtable Podcast, not AARP, but Miami RRP. And then finally, my company is a sponsor of this podcast. Please check out condovultures.com if you are interested in anything related to condos. So until next time, everybody take care of yourself and we'll catch up soon. Ciao, ciao.
It's a simple formula and it works. Buy low, sell high. We're Condo Vultures. And when it comes to your real estate, we help you buy low. At Condo Vultures, we represent the buyer. And now's the time to buy. Log on to condovultures.com for more information. Condovultures.com. And remember, before you sell high, you have to buy low. Featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes, and Time Magazine. Condo Vultures Realty, a licensed Florida real estate brokerage capitalizing on the condo correction since 2006.
Don't buy a South Florida condo, discounted or distressed, before taking a Condo Vultures correction tour. Condovultures.com offers weekly bus and walking tours that focus on educating buyers on the how-tos of identifying discounted condos, analyzing the opportunities, and purchasing units. Every tour attendee receives a list of all condo projects in a particular market, a market assessment handout, and unmatched expert analysis. For more information on the condo correction tours, please visit condovultures.eventbrite.com.